Well, let's see. Tech is, in and of itself, a four-letter word. You know what's a four-letter word for the tech industry? Regulation. That's what. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 3rd of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It was, depending on how you look at it, an awkward bit of timing. Smack in the middle of Apple's big annual developer conference today came word via Reuters that the Department of Justice has been given jurisdiction over a potential antitrust investigation of that company. There have been similar reports past couple of days about possible investigations into Google and Facebook and Amazon. Same general topic, antitrust. So we got the host of Marketplace Tech, Molly Wood, on the phone to make me smart about all this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So a lot of reports, as I said. What do we know about what's going on?
Well, we mostly know that this is about authorization and jurisdiction. So no official inquiries or investigations have been launched. It's kind of about divvying up who's in charge. So the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice are our two kind of antitrust bodies. Right now, it sounds like the Justice Department's going to take Google and Apple as far as that goes. And the FTC is going to stick with Amazon and everybody else.
Everybody
Facebook
else.
In
Facebook,
particular.
Right. Yeah. and with which they will have their hands full, right? But let's talk about the Department of Justice. What might they start looking into?
Well, you know, there are a couple things at play here when it comes to this anti-competitive behavior. And that's mainly what they're worried about. In terms of Google, it's going to be whether Google uses its dominance in search to then dominate digital advertising, and whether it prioritizes its own services at the expense of others. So Yelp and TripAdvisor have complained for years that Google puts sort of its own results and its own services at the top of search. And then, of course, the digital advertising market really is only Google and Facebook at this point. When it comes to Apple, it's whether Apple is unfairly taking that 30% cut from services and subscriptions in the App Store and whether it prioritizes its own apps and services, which it obviously does, on its devices over potential competition.
There has been oh so very much talk about regulation and privacy and all of that. Most of it happening, though, over in the EU. So what, you know, in your experience, is the likelihood of this actually going anywhere in this country?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, deciding who's got the badge is definitely not the same thing as sending somebody to jail.
Right.
And so far, we have seen a lot of talk about action against these companies, talk of privacy regulation that has not turned into specifics here in the United States. Whatever does end up happening could even just be more fines and consent decrees. We're a long way, you know, from breaking these companies up. But look, the Justice Department, that's serious business. Microsoft lost 10 years, arguably, of innovation to a Justice Department investigation and had to profoundly change the way it does business. So if they get in the game at a high level, it will shake things up a lot.
Quick Apple bonus question. We got a half a minute left. They have largely been left out of this big, bad tech conversation, right? It's been Amazon and Google and Facebook are the bad guys. Where's Apple coming from on this?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because the stuff that Microsoft did get sued for in the 90s, force bundling its browser and services and apps, that's the literal hallmark of how Apple works. It just hasn't been big enough to matter until the iPhone got so dominant.
Huh. It's that closed ecosystem, right? Isn't that the...
It absolutely is. And now that iPhone is everywhere. And, you know, credit to Spotify for raising the alarm about Apple's cut. That's what really focused the spotlight.
Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, also with me, a podcast on which, like 2 weeks ago, right, Molly, we talked about antitrust and big tech. It's called Make Me Smart.
Good timing.
Right? You didn't think we'd planned it this way. Molly Wood. Thanks, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
There was other news at that big Apple conference today, one of which will come as music to the ears of people who've been complaining about iTunes for lo these many years now. The service, as we know it, is going away after 18 years of increasingly unpopular existence. Why? Well, as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, consumers have just moved on.
When iTunes launched back in 2001, Max Houck of St. Petersburg, Florida, transferred his CDs to the Apple software, and he spent several $1,000s in the iTunes music store. But he says iTunes got harder to use with every software update. Last year, Houck switched to Spotify, a streaming subscription service.
I've got like 90% of the music that I love available to me, and I take it with me on my phone. It's on my desktop. It's everywhere. It's fantastic.
iTunes, which has expanded way beyond music, is splitting its service into three apps: music, TV, and podcasts. Michael Smith, professor at Carnegie Mellon, says over time, iTunes became
this ugly bloatware piece of software as Apple tried to add new things into it to make it, you know, not just music, but also movies and television shows and books. And it just became a mess.
As iTunes begins to fade away, NYU business professor Scott Galloway says it's important to remember that when it launched, digital music piracy was a huge problem,
which gave iTunes an opening and the motivation for the music industry to enter into what was a bit of a Sophie's choice. And that was to either let their music continue to be stolen or let Apple come in and disrupt the industry.
By selling individual songs for 99 cents. He says while iTunes was born of piracy, the music business has moved on. And now, so will Apple's iTunes. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Wall Street this first Monday in June, a little bit down, except the tech-heavy NASDAQ. See the aforementioned four-letter word. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a big retail story today that is not about retailers at all. The investment firm Blackstone Group is going to pay $18.7 billion to buy warehouse space from the Singaporean company GLP. 179 million square feet of warehouse space, to be precise. They are big business, those warehouses, don't you know, as we buy ever more stuff online and expect it to arrive ever faster. Just today, Amazon said it started rolling out its previously announced one-day delivery, free delivery service for Prime members on more than 10 million items. Walmart announced the same thing last month. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
This is the bar now for online shopping. People want their blueberries and stain remover now, or at least by tomorrow if they have to wait. And that, says Kathy Robertson with Logistics Trends and Insights, is good for the warehouse business.
It is a hot area because you got to have somewhere to put all this stuff.
Ideally, somewhere close to a lot of your customers. Many of the warehouses Blackstone is buying are in dense metro areas like San Francisco, Chicago, and Miami. Amazon is one tenant, but also Home Depot, Petco, and Wayfair.
Walmart, Target, you name them, are all trying to fulfill that product faster and more efficiently. And by doing that, they are moving closer to the customer.
That's expensive. Real estate and labor cost more in big cities, but so is the so-called last mile problem, the challenge of getting products from the distribution center to the customer. Barb Ivanoff directs the Urban Freight Lab at the University of Washington. She says Blackstone's investment suggests there's a lot of money to be made closing that gap.
What I think is really interesting is that by coming back into the greater downtown area, some really smart people with a big bag of money are saying, indeed, this is a fabulous growth opportunity.
A startup called Flex just raised its own bag of money, $43 million, to match small and medium-sized retailers with spare warehouse space with the promise of next-day delivery. In Denver, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A story now about, well, brand ingenuity, I guess you'd say. Nike's got a new ad out for the Women's World Cup. That's soccer, for those who don't follow. It starts this week. It's 3 minutes long, this ad is, and it features a 10-year-old soccer player named McKenna Cook on the field alongside her heroes. Subtle Nike swooshes all over the place, a Just Do It or two. But wait a minute here, I see you saying, because, Kai, the more astute among you will know that Nike is not the tournament's official sponsor. Adidas paid the big bucks for those bragging rights. So what gives? Well, Marketplace's Mario Segarra is on that one.
In this ad, McKenna Cook is right in the thick of a soccer match that looks like it could be the final of the Women's World Cup. But at no point does the ad actually use the phrase Women's World Cup. That right is reserved for the official sponsors of the tournament: Coca-Cola, Visa, Adidas. Victor Matheson at the College of the Holy Cross says they also get to plaster their name all over the stadiums and related events.
But just because they're the official sponsor of the World Cup doesn't mean that Nike has to stop advertising. And it doesn't mean that Nike has to stop advertising with respect to women's soccer.
Sponsorship rights can cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Wendy Dees, who teaches sports marketing at the University of Miami, says what Nike's doing is much cheaper.
They don't like to overpay for big global rights fees when they can save all of that money. They can just make really creative advertising, and everybody watches that and they run it over and over.
So for Adidas, what's the point of being an official sponsor? Victor Matheson at Holy Cross says Adidas is probably thinking about benefits long after the tournament is over.
It hopes that every college women's soccer team next fall is going to be using the official tournament balls from the event here.
And it gets guaranteed eyeballs on its products. More than 760 million people watched the last Women's World Cup 4 years ago. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
We're out this week with our latest Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Poll, the eighth time we have gone to the phone banks to get a quantified sense of how people are feeling about all things economy. In particular, we have been keeping track of something we call our Economic Anxiety Index. It's the lowest we've ever measured it right now, 28 this time around. The high was 36 right before the 2016 election. So the headline number does show some optimism about the economy in general. Away from the headlines, here's a sample from some of the people we polled.
My name is Dan Gann, and I'm calling from Pleasant Grove, Utah. I work for Vivint Solar, a residential solar installer, and I retired from school teaching after 33 years, elementary education, and then started looking for another job. My kids, a couple of them already worked in this company, suggested I try there, and I did, and I'm making more now than I did as a school teacher after 33 years. The downside is I work all year long, whereas I used to have summer to do other things. So it just looks very busy, and I'm optimistic.
I'm Jackie Vimo, and I'm calling from Orlando, Florida. There's a lot of buzz about how great the economy is in terms of numbers, but that is not my experience. I'm a person who went to graduate school to get a PhD. I'm also married to another PhD, but ultimately we don't know, you know, one day to another what's going to happen next year with our jobs. And the academic job market is extremely difficult, does require a lot of moving and also a lot of uncertainty for those of us who, you know, who decided that we wanted to go into academia.
Hi, my name is Janelle, calling from Norfolk, Virginia. The economy for me right now is kind of unstable, sort of treading water, but at some points I'm definitely below it. This kind of rolls into the place that I work. I'm working for a subservicer of mortgage companies. Basically, I used to be on the phones where you more or less take phone calls, answer questions. What's really working against me right now is actually the fact that I technically took a promotion, but in doing so, I lost about $500 in income. Because it's such a high stress environment, depending on what's going on, especially with big transfers and the whole things with hurricanes and all the disaster plans and everything like that, even with the government shutdown, we had high call volumes, and the call volumes are basically what gets you your bonuses. But in taking that promotion to be off the phones, which really stressed me to the point where I was physically getting sick. So that's basically why I kind of feel not really safe at the moment, but I am getting back to the point where I am above water in this economy.
That was Dan Gann from Pleasant Grove, Utah. Jackie Vimo calling from Orlando, Florida. Janelle Cooper as well there at the end from Norfolk, Virginia. We asked a bunch of questions in this version of our poll about the place most of us spend a good portion of our waking hours and how we feel about it. Spoiler alert, we are mixed about our workplaces. We've got all the data from the latest Marketplace Edison Research poll on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
Because if you take those jobs out of the town, And at this point, I don't know how you replace them.
Nobody does, but they are sure going to try. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is basically flat today, up 4 points, closed at 24,819. The Nasdaq down 120 points, 1.6%, 73.33. The Nasdaq officially now in correction territory, defined as, come on, you know it. Yes, that's off more than 10% from its most recent high. The S&P 500 fell 7 points, 0.2%, 27.44. Antitrust, as we said, hit the tech sector. Alphabet, parent company of Google, lost 6.1%. Facebook down 7.5%. Amazon down 4.6%. Apple today got off easy, unplugged 1%. To name more difficulties for Boeing, the FAA says some 737 jets might have faulty wing parts, leading edge slat tracks, for those of you in the know. Boeing off more than 0.75% today. You're listening to Marketplace. If you're a member of your local public radio station, we thank you because your support helps those stations keep programs like Marketplace on the air. But for Marketplace to really grow, we need additional investment from those who care most about what we do, superfans like you. Your donation helps us create more content that matters to you and your community and to reach more people where they are, whether that's radio, podcasts, or online. Become a Marketplace investor today at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back in the day, conventional wisdom was that you didn't bring religion or politics to work. This just in, times have changed, and those bright lines, they are not so bright anymore. CEOs of big companies are weighing in on everything from LGBTQ rights to immigration, and people who work at, just to name two, Google and Amazon, have rallied recently to change their company's policies on defense contracts and climate change. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more now on how business is getting personal.
Walk into any WeWork co-working space, and it's like a design magazine come to life. The WeWork in downtown Los Angeles is all blonde woods and trendy patterned rugs. There's the trademark fruit water. This one's cucumber pineapple. And in the lobby, a glass sign that reads, "Do what you love." The aspirational workplace is what WeWork is all about. Living your best work life. Not just with Instagram-ready interiors, but with corporate policies, too.
We decided as a company that we were not going to use company money to buy meat.
Lindsay Baker is the head of sustainability for WeWork. She says the meatless rule doesn't apply to clients in the co-working spaces, but rather employees and company events.
We really wanted to put our values into practice in the company and take a stand for something that we believed in.
A meat-free corporate culture is one example of a broader trend. Personal beliefs are moving front and center in the professional world. That includes politics.
Your political identity is a more clear signal of what your values and worldview are than it was in the past.
Neil Malhotra is a political economist at Stanford. He says increased polarization is changing how Americans think about work.
People are increasingly wanting to work for places that share their values and will put their money where their mouth is to do it.
In a study, Malhotra found online job seekers were willing to take a pay cut to work for a like-minded boss. And in a survey from staffing firm Randstad, more than a third of workers said they would leave a company over political disagreements. That was the case for investment advisor Noel Pinson of Leland, Virginia, who says he felt like a lonely liberal in his small, mostly conservative office.
I just felt over time, just more and more, that little voice in the back of my head screaming at me that you're not living your values working here.
So he decided to strike out on his own.
There were several months that I had without income. All this was happening right as I was having a baby.
Most workers aren't taking such bold actions. Instead, some are making change from within. Che Huang is the CEO of online retailer Boxed, which sells groceries and household goods in bulk. He says a female employee once confronted him in the hallway and demanded he address the pink tax, the premium often charged for women's health and beauty products, estimated to cost each woman upwards of $1,300 a year.
And I was like, I don't know what the pink tax is, but let me get my coffee, and we're going to talk all about that in about 10 minutes.
Huang listened and decided to rebate customers for taxes paid on feminine goods, a move he says has cost the company more than $1 million over 3 years, but inspires loyalty among his workers, helpful in an industry where it's hard to keep talent.
We can't match the cash compensation, say, that an Uber or Google will pay, but yet it actually has helped a lot on the retention.
Research shows sharing values can help workers bond and increase an organization's productivity. But that makes holding a minority view all the more difficult.
My viewpoint is, you know, right of center, free market, liberty oriented.
If Garrett Johnson sounds a little shy about identifying as a conservative, it might be because he works in Silicon Valley, a bastion of liberal activism. Johnson is a co-founder of the Lincoln Network, which connects conservative-leaning tech workers. The group released a survey earlier this year with almost two-thirds of respondents at politically active tech companies saying employees would be ridiculed or ostracized for expressing opposing views.
It causes people to pull back, to not speak up, not offer their perspectives, which is not good.
Johnson believes there can be benefits to greater political expression in the workplace, but companies need better training to promote constructive dialogue, something that will surely come in handy as we gear up for another grueling election season. In Los Angeles, I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
One of the things about non-renewable sources of energy is that the jobs that come with those industries, coal, oil eventually, are non-renewable as well. So one community in southwestern Wyoming is being forced to imagine life without coal at its center. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Jim Bills stands under a carport at his white ranch-style home in Kimmer, Wyoming. He's lived in the city for the past 40 years. Worked at the Kimmer coal mine as a truck driver, laborer, and driller for 35 until he retired. The mine, along with the power plant it feeds, are central pieces of the local economy.
You know, a year ago, the town was going smooth. Same thing it's been doing for 100 years, a nice place to live, everybody's happy. We didn't see it coming.
What Kimmer didn't see coming was that a large utility put its local power plant on a list of possible closures in 3 years. That's on top of the local coal mine's owner, Westmoreland, filing for bankruptcy last year. It caused retirees like Bills to lose out on medical benefits. The news shook Kimmer, says Mayor Tony Tomasi.
I thought, well, I'm seeing what it says, but this can't be real.
Tomasi's driving around Kimmer in neighboring Diamondville. He says the area was built by coal. We pass a cement wall with an engraved image of figures taking a pickaxe to coal, abandoned antique shops, and a park called Miner's Memorial. Tomasi points out a recreation center that was built by energy companies.
The industry got together, built it, paid for it through a bond that they taxed themselves on.
In December, PacifiCorp announced it would be cheaper to switch to renewables or gas than keep running over half of its coal plants. No final decisions have been made about plant closures. Kimmer's Naughton Power Plant was already scheduled to close in 2029. But several scenarios in this new plan have it closing 7 years earlier, in 2022. Tomasi says the closure would mean the loss of 126 jobs and others connected to it. Trucking companies, cement suppliers, electricians, and the largest, the Kimmer coal mine, that employs more than 250 people. It relies on Naughton as its primary customer. If both the mine and plant went under, it would mean the loss of hundreds of jobs and the two largest taxpayers in the county.
Because if you take those jobs out of the town, and at this point I don't know how you replace them.
He says all the uncertainty is hurting business. His car dealership isn't selling as much. You can see for sale signs on homes all over town. A local realtor says property values are declining. So in December, Tomasi and other city leaders came together to discuss plans for a revitalized Kimmer. Plans that don't lean quite so heavily on coal. They hired a new city administrator, Brian Muir, to focus on that. And he's been busy with conferences, consultant meetings.
Careful, strategic planning is really even more important for our community than it ever has been because of, we've been in the coal for decades.
Muir helped put together an action plan with an aggressive timeline. Its three main points: diversify the economy, increase manufacturing, and boost quality housing. He's looking at tourism opportunities, maybe attracting visitors interested in fossils. 50 million years ago, this area was full of tropical lakes. Robert Bowen owns a fossil shop in town. In the dusty back room of Wyoming Fossils, Bowen sifts through squares of stone with imprints of small fish, leaves, and even insects.
They're just no two the same.
He says quarries nearby have accessible fossils. The city could take advantage of that, market it more, gear vacation homes to it.
It's not a cure, but it will help.
You know, every little bit we can do is going to help us.
Back at his home, Jim Bills, who retired from the coal mining company, says he loves living here. He's always known it as an energy city, though, and struggles to imagine something else.
Hopefully there are solutions, but not three-year solutions. Not that it's going to happen in 3 years, and this town will just dry up and blow away.
PacifiCorp will make its closure decision for the Naughton Power Plant on August 1st. In Kimmer, Wyoming, I'm Cooper McKim for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we're going to note this here just for the record because you've probably already heard. We learned last night the head of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, Kevin Hassett, is going to be leaving. I was about to say that Hassett announced his departure, but his boss did in a tweet. Of course, two quick things. Hassett pointed out this morning, and he is right, that it's just about average for CEA chairs to leave at the two-year mark, which this is. But it's also right that Hassett is more free trade and pro-immigration than his boss is. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 4 points today. We'll call that flat. The S&P 500 down 7. That's 0.2%. The NASDAQ is the biggie today, down 120 points, 1.6%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.